It's humbling to be here with this panel and in this audience, for that matter. I think everyone in this room, I think we all have this growing appreciation of one of the overarching themes of the conversation that we're having in this topic, which is the issue of equity and access to surgical care from the global perspective. And it's a problem. It's not a small problem. It's an extraordinarily large public health care crisis in the globe. My base is in Canada, and I can say that that's the same issue that we have in the Canadian environment as well. There's huge issues with equity and access in our remote and rural regions as well. They pale in comparison to much of the rest of the world, however. And I think what we've heard today is this incredibly eloquent conversation that examines some of the professionalization and a bit more thoughtfulness in how we are trying to address and what small role the American College and all of its member fellows and other allied supporters can engage with us in how we improve this issue of disequity and inequity in access to care for surgical patients. We've heard how we're beginning to organize the educational framework from a medical student level through to a postgraduate trainee level into a fellowship level, and how we're trying to frame how can we expose our young leadership and the leadership at the young age of the spectrum for our profession is really quite dramatic and quite frankly leading the charge in this way, and you can see how that's changing over time. Looking at the academic center and faith-based centers and how that's becoming a much more professionalized endeavor. It's very impressive to see the training paradigms and the results and the impact of that change, as was eloquently described by both Russ and Dr. Very impressive work that's being done. We see the ways in which one can engage with this in different forms. So I'd like to open it up for questions from the floor, if there are any right now, and just to say that it's extremely impressive to see this crowd here today. Yes. Please state who you are for us, please. And also, we can't really see you, so it's hard to. Mics, please, or just speak extremely loudly.
Just speak up.
Oh, there we go.
I think we got it. Hey, Dr. Katz from Miami, Florida. First of all, thank you so much for sharing with us your vast experience. And I have good news for you. The American passport is still respected and appreciated across the globe. My specific question is, considering the fact that we have these advancements of technology, video, audio, and so on, how can we help internationally via video conferencing and direct assistance?
Open to the group.
I should restate it. Sorry, is it?
How can we use telemedicine technology to enhance our ability to address some of the issues in the equity and access to surgical care?
I think we can think about telemedicine in two ways. One, education in terms of people who do not have access to, say, the city, and when you're trying to train remotely, either operatively or non-operatively. And secondly, can you adequately deliver clinical care via telemedicine? I think the first thing is you have to establish a relationship with wherever the site is and have faith and trust in your local partners. You need surgeons on the ground to be able to receive whatever education you're trying to impart remotely. And that's what you need to start. But the larger issue, of course, is investments. You have to be able to pay for it. You have to be able to maintain it. And as we all know, if you go to most low and medium income countries, not just medical devices, even computers, once they break down, the whole thing falls apart. And so the two larger issues is maintenance and, of course, cost of setting it up. But I think academic medical centers are uniquely positioned to help in telemedicine and telementoring.
Yeah, I think we're underutilizing that technology, and there's a lot of room for growth there to improve our use of that to enhance opportunities. I think we'll move on to another question. There's quite a few people in the line, so thank you very much for that. Next question on this side. We'll just rotate back and forth from the two sides.
First of all, thank you for a beautiful variety in talks. My question pertains to the topic of the global shortage of access to surgical care, obviously. I would like to hear some of your opinions on taking on the multifaceted problem that it is. Do you have a certain thing in mind that would be the most pressing, the most urgent factor to address right now?
What is the number one problem? Russ, why don't you take this?
Difficult question. From my perspective, and what I decided 25 years ago is that the long-term benefits will come with the educational programs, and that my own father was a medical missionary in the Congo, and he treated lots of people, thousands. When he died, that was the end of that. We're now training hundreds and hundreds of surgeons who stay there and will stay there. So it's a 25, 50 year project, but to me that's where the money is. And if I can speak candidly, support those groups that are doing it in the field, that are training surgeons, like the College of Surgeons of East Central and Southern Africa, training 600 surgeons now. We don't need new plans. We don't need all the new programs coming in. We need support in what's actually going on there. That's a long answer to your question. Sorry about that.
The other larger issue, of course, is that you have to work with the local governments. We can parachute in all we want. If the local government hasn't bought in into the care of their own people, it's going to be very hard to change. And so I think fixing the sort of the local governmental structure.
Yeah, equity and partnership and looking at the long haul in terms of education, that's just as it is in our own environment, it's that's what's going to change the future is generation by generation. And a surgical generation is not 25 years. It's 3 to 6 years of training. So it is a feasible thing. Thank you for the question. We'll go to the next mic over there, please.
Eugene Lee from Sacramento. My question is a short one. In preparation of going on some of these trips, what language would you suggest to learn, if any, and if it's a local language, how best to prepare in going to these sites where English is not frequently spoken?
Any language preferences?
Well, I would choose Swahili personally, but that's East Africa. There are many, like for example, if you go online, there's medical Swahili. There are small books you can get. I suspect there are medical French and medical German if you're somewhere that is requiring, or Portuguese. But I think you're going to end up relying heavily on interpreters no matter where you go. The good thing we're surgeons, and so we can poke and prod, and you learn the words for pain and breathe and vomit and things like that. And it helps.
Yeah, I think one of the things it's good to be, English goes a long way, and we're very fortunate with that translatability of that language across the globe. But it's very important to be reflective of the local languages and take the time to at least do a little bit of research on the local language and learn a little bit of the local language. It goes a long way. Next question, please.
Aisha Lovick, I'm a fifth-year general surgery resident in Atlanta. My question's for Dr. Yoder. As I'm transitioning into looking for a career, my ideal career would be something like what Dr. Charles described, an academic situation where I can incorporate global surgery as a part of my job description. But I have given some consideration to locums. What are your thoughts or opinions on locums as a fresh graduate or a junior attending from the standpoint of surgical experience as well as loan repayment?
Right, that's a great question. I was actually hoping someone would ask that. I personally spent 4 years working in a private practice model, and after I finished my fellowship training, and I would strongly recommend spending some time in a practice environment prior to jumping directly into locums. Because what happens when you go into locums is you're working in multiple different practice environments and you don't really have a time to kind of set your feet and get used to being an attending. So I would recommend pursuing some sort of other opportunity or job where you could get global exposure prior to jumping into doing locums work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take this as the last question as we're running out of time in the session.
Okay, hi. My name's Ashley Morgan, and I'm also a graduating general surgery resident. I'm about to start a fellowship in cardiothoracic surgery, and so I was really excited that cardiac surgery was part of what you guys talked about today. And my question is, how can other people replicate what you've done in Kenya? And how do you emphasize to local governments and international funding sources that this kind of technologically intensive surgery in certain ways should be a priority?
Sure, thank you very much for the question. I did general surgical training and then cardiothoracic training with a view towards going to Africa, thinking I would never use heart surgery, ever. I was very interested in esophageal and pulmonary surgery, and I made it clear we were not going to do heart surgery in Kenya because it just would not be achievable. That was 25 years ago. 10 years ago, I was convinced after a long time that it really was needed and could be done, and as of right now, I have 600 kids on a waiting list for valve surgery. It goes on and on and on, and we've developed that program. We are working with the government, so we have an approved cardiothoracic fellowship. We are some of our first fellows were actually our first graduates in general surgery. And so there is a desire. For example, the College of Surgeons of East Central Southern Africa, which we are the first accredited cardiothoracic program. The need is huge, and the governments recognize it, that it is there. It's very true what one of the other speakers said. Working with the government is what we all want. We're not in competition. We want to work together. So I sit on one of the boards of medical practitioners in the country to help make some of those decisions, and that only comes after being there a long time. But we do have options available for that. My goal, you ask about replicating it, we're starting cardiothoracic fellowship training, perfusion training, critical care nurses training, cardiac anesthesia training, so that if a team from Malawi, it's interesting, the Malamulo group had contacted me and said, can we send you a surgeon to learn heart surgery in 6 months? And I said, no. But in a few years from now, you can send us a whole team and we'll train that whole team over a period. And then you have a good chance of reproducing that somewhere else. Thank you.
Dr. Walworth, you have a comment?
It was great to hear the medical student and the resident talk about their efforts, but they should not forget that they need nursing students with them, they need anesthesia residents with them, they need support staff, social workers, engineers. Global surgery depends on global health as a whole, so don't just concentrate on surgery.
Thank you for that. It's very much a team game, as we all know. So I'd just like to thank the audience, and I'd like to thank the panel as well.